The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'd like to thank the Thomistic Institute for inviting me and all the organizers and everyone here for having persevered. Now that we have a bit of tea in us, we can continue. A few years ago, I was approached by some Catholic technologists who they were asking for my advice about developing what they said was going to be the premier Catholic artificial intelligence platform. They wanted to compete with ChatGPT, Gemini, or other similar offerings, but they said they wanted to sandbox it and make it entirely Catholic. In other words, they wanted to ensure that it only drew from reliable Catholic sources, such as the magisterial documents of the Church, the Church Fathers, of course, St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, I was interested in trying to assist them in this early stage in their development, but I also expressed some interest as to what the use would be. And the fellow who was talking with me said, well, we envision it that it's going to be used by, say, religious sisters in preparing talks for their religious education classes, and perhaps priests can use it to prepare their homilies. Now, I thought about my experience teaching in Rome. I've been there for 12 years now, and I was very surprised in my time there. I found some religious sisters having plagiarized some of their materials. It's true. And some seminarians having done the same thing. And so I asked the technologist, I said, well, are you concerned that maybe people might use this for those kinds of ends, fraud or inauthenticity or at least laziness? And he sort of dismissed it and talked about how widely used this product was going to be. Well, 6 weeks ago this year, February 19 in 2026, I heard Pope Leo speaking to the priests of Rome, and he addressed this very point. Here's what he said, quote, I invite you to resist the temptation to prepare homilies with artificial intelligence. Just as all the muscles of the body die if we don't use them, well, if we do not move them, the brain, it needs to be used. And so our intelligence, your intelligence, needs to be exercised a little. AI will never be able to share the faith. Now, at this point, I'm not saying I told you so. Far be it from me to gloat before dinner. But what I'm interested in is how AI specifically relates to the Catholic faith. How do we understand it as Catholics and Christians? And so I'm going to focus not on digital technology in its wide scope, as we saw from our previous lecture, which was fantastic. I'm going to focus specifically on AI and the things that we're familiar with, those large language models that you can interact with. By way of introduction, I would say it's interesting if we step back for a moment, the fact that AI is itself part of the conversation, that far more people are discussing artificial intelligence, I think, than most of the other new recent digital technologies. Now, the church has been quite interested in talking about social media, at least since the 1930s. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but in 1931, the first person to use a radio publicly was Pope Pius XI. He inaugurated Vatican radio with the inventor of the radio, Guglielmo Marconi, and he gave a worldwide address. In 1957, Pope Pius XII, he wrote an encyclical describing how the church understands movies, television, and radio, and how it can be used for good or evil. Isn't that interesting? 1957, the church is trying to talk about these things. And in 2002, there was a not very well-known document called The Church and the Internet. And instead of showing the lights and the shadows that were discussed in the 1950s, this one was a lot more positive, seeing media and the internet as a way to evangelize, or at least to share information that previously was unavailable. And then finally, this year, in 2025, the church put out a document called Antiqua et Nova, a note on the relationship between artificial intelligence and human intelligence. So we can just say that the church has tried to approach these things in a formal way to give people at least some guidelines, some markers about how to approach these new media and how they relate to our salvation and the message of Christ. I'm not going to review those documents for you. In fact, if you type them into ChatGPT, it'll give you a summary, but it'll also give you a hallucination. I did this, and it made up a number of encyclicals by non-existent popes, which I found, you know, interesting. And instead, what I want to do is first, let's start out with the basic anthropology as we as Christians understand it. So I thought that Dr. McNamara gave a wonderful philosophical presentation describing how does the intellect work. We as subjects are receiving, you know, the truth of the world, and we want to have an objective understanding of them. Now it transforms us. In the book of Genesis, we find that it tells us about the nature of man. Jews and Christians alike traditionally recognize that the human being among all bodily creatures is made after the image and likeness of God. Scripture says that God said, "Let us make man in our image." And so God created man in his image. In the words of Thomas Aquinas, he says, "Man is made in the image insofar as we have an intelligent being endowed with free choice and self-movement." We are made in the image of God insofar as we have free choice and self-movement. And so this helps us to perform our actions, to have agency in the world. St. John Paul II, in describing this in relation to the Blessed Trinity, he says that just as the Blessed Trinity forever is three co-equal persons in perfect harmony and perfect unity of divinity, so likewise, man reflects God's personal nature. He says, man becomes the image of God through his humanity and through our communion with other persons. Man and woman reflect this personal communion from the very beginning. And so Adam was alone until Eve came on the scene. And so because of this, then the way we need to understand the world is both in terms of the nature of our soul and our ability to have intellective insight, but also our relations with other people. And so the image of God then is something that is reflected primarily in our spirit, but also in our very bodily nature. You know that the human body has a symbolism that speaks of spirituality. The fact that we have a larger brain than all of the other terrestrial creatures is an indication that we have more brain power. We're able to do things that they can't proportionally. And so we can say then that man made in the image of God is something that God wanted to show exteriorly through our bodily being. In Genesis, it says that God makes man in his image. He takes this previously existing material and he breathes into its nostrils the breath of life. And subsequently, man and woman cooperate with God in a way that is in accordance with nature. How do we live out being the image of God? By coming to know the truth, by loving the good, and by having communion with other persons. And so it's through being with other persons that our own personality and our own, as it were, reflection of the divinity comes to be realized. I would say, in contrast, what we might call the myth of the machine, and especially of artificial intelligence, it offers a narrative that persons, or something like persons, can be crafted by manufacture, literally by the work of human hands. And there's perhaps no better parable than this, not Frankenstein, but actually an older one that Mary Shelley was drawing upon. Maybe you know about this, that Mary Shelley, in her work about Frankenstein, was offering the modern view of the material world. And of course, it's electricity that vivifies this creature, this monster, this one that rampages. But there's an older story from the early Middle Ages that tells a similar narrative, but with a much more profound understanding of symbolic nature and how we relate to it. And this is a Jewish story that has ties even to the Talmud, over 1,500 years old. Polish Jews say that there was a Jew in Poland named Rabbi Eliyahu Baal Sem, who he made what was called a golem. Namely, he took clay from the ground and he made it into the shape of a human being. He made all the fingers and the toes. He made the legs and the arms. He made the torso and finally the head. In order to have this thing become alive, he took a stylus and he wrote on its forehead the Hebrew word for truth, emes. And from there, it suddenly became, as it were, animate. This golem, G-O-L-E-M, and actually this is where Tolkien got the word golem, is a kind of a not quite human person. And so this golem, it stands up, and at first it was there to serve him. The rabbi wanted this golem, this creature, to, you know, sweep and do housework and so on. But it kept growing and getting stronger. And in most versions of the legend, this golem becomes so strong it overpowers the rabbi. And it turns out to rampage the local village. It uses its power that it got from the rabbi in ways that the rabbi didn't expect. When the rabbi realized that he could no longer control it, he and a number of other Jews in their quarter had to chase this thing down. They had to pin it to the ground, or they had to trick it in some way. And so one story is that they commanded the golem to like look at the ground. It looks down and then they wipe the name of truth off of its forehead and then it collapses into dust. And so it's back into clay and the rabbi never made it again. Now, the implications of this story, I think, are quite profound for artificial intelligence, because the first thing I would point out is that as the philosopher Jacques Ellul, he was a philosopher of technology, also a Christian. He said, technology is not neutral. Technology is not neutral. We often think of technology as a simple tool that we can use in one way or another. So I can use this cup either to drink with, or I can use it to throw water on people. I can use it, you know, to hit somebody with, or I can use it as a decoration. So someone would say, well, this water glass is neutral. But in fact, it's not, because as our previous speaker pointed out, all technology starts to shape the person who uses it. So first, technology has its own desire, you might say. It's an embedded teleology that was put there by the manufacturer. So the nature of this is to be able to hold water in a stable manner, such that it won't leak, that I can see what the water is, and that it makes it, you know, available to a person with hands about my size. Whereas we can say that, if I said that this little battery was my water holder, you would say, well, of course, this is impossible. This can't hold water. So, well, what does it mean? It means that the battery wants something different than what the cup wants. What the cup wants is to be filled, and it's reached its goal. What the battery wants is to be used, is to have a positive and negative charge on either end, so it can expel, it can have a chemical reaction, and then suddenly it's making something work. So technology in itself is not an inert or we might say a structure that has no meaning of its own or meaning that's only embedded by the user. In fact, we would say technology has a certain demand because it has a form, and the form is the meaning embedded in it by its maker. And therefore, technology then can conform people to the form that it has. You ever had a dream about, you know, technology? It's kind of interesting. You know, sometimes people have anxieties or something, and there can be an object in their dream. Maybe you're afraid of a car or something like that. Well, this means that the form that you've absorbed it by seeing it or using it, and now it's inside of you. By grasping it with your senses and then your intellect, now this form resides within you. And so likewise, we can say that we can completely agree that AI does not have authentic agency, but it does have teleology. In other words, it has a goal. What are the goals? Well, we heard part of it is to steal your attention. Part of it is to provide you enough information in order to make you engage with it even more. So that's the first thing we learn, is that no technology is neutral. Just as the golem may not have been fully responsible for its actions, nevertheless, it had a shape, and the shape was human. The second thing that we can learn from the story about, you know, this creature constructed by the rabbi that's moving about because of the name on its forehead, is that symbols bear meaning, and the symbolic meaning that's embedded upon them can affect people who engage with them. We might say that the manufacturer of the golem, it was a rabbi, the 16th century, a wise man, almost a magician. And it's very interesting. I thought the example that was used previously about saying electricity isn't like a magical thing that somehow makes it closer to rationality than if it were water pipes and so on. Nevertheless, Arthur C. Clarke, who is a he was a science fiction writer, he points out, he says, any technology that is sufficiently advanced becomes indistinguishable from magic. Any technology that is sufficiently advanced becomes indistinguishable from magic. From our perspective, even though we can say that there's a rationality behind it and it works according to certain laws of nature, nevertheless, our experience of it is, as it were, magic. It's similar to, there's a novel by Mark Twain, which isn't very good, a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. He imagines what would happen if this, you know, Connecticut Yankee circa 1870s goes back to the Middle Ages, and he has technology like, explosives. And so now suddenly King Arthur's court, they're very excited by this, but they're also afraid. Maybe he's a wizard to match Merlin and so on. And what Twain is pointing out is similar to what Arthur C. Clarke points out, namely that a lot of technology, even to people who use it daily, seems like magic. Unless you're quite habituated to it, then it seems like nature. So what I would say then is that when the Hebrew name Truth was embedded on the forehead of this creature, this shows us something of a deep irony, because in fact, the thing was not human, but it used truth as a sort of talismanic word in order to influence the world. It inevitably is exposed to its own lack of functioning because it doesn't reason like a human being. It rampages like an angry animal. And so likewise, we might say that even if artificial intelligence passes what we call the Turing test, meaning that it fools individuals into thinking that, you know, it acts rationally, nevertheless, the fool is the one who doesn't accept the truth about its nature. So it uses truth sort of as this moniker. You know, it supposedly has access to something that we don't, but in fact, it's an imprisoned spirit somehow put there by a rational power. The third thing I would say is that the destructiveness of this golem parallels a lot of concerns that people have about the dangers of artificial intelligence. You know, there's sort of apocalyptic trajectories where we have some robot, you know, that has a machine gun or something. The Terminator movies that came out when I was a child, we were fascinated by that. And but there are other concerns. Dr. McCann actually said that, you know, maybe we need to, you know, pause the way we use it, or we need to adjust our way of approaching it. And this is actually expressed, I don't know if you know this, by Frank Herbert, the author of the Dune novels. So he describes in his Dune novels this, what he calls the Butlerian Jihad. Namely, it's where some point in the future that AI is so advanced that it starts to undermine human creativity and it starts to remove people's ability to engage in the world. And so humanity as a whole decides they're going to destroy these advanced artificial intelligences and robots. And in fact, they come up with a commandment which runs, "Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind." And that's what saves humanity in this sort of fictional future. Of course, God, he creates man in his own image, but when man makes something in the image of the human mind, it seems like we know things can go wrong. Just as Israel was commanded not to make a graven image of God, perhaps we ought to not make graven images of our interior selves. But lest people think that I'm calling for any kind of jihad, Butlerian or otherwise, I'll back away from this narrative for a moment because this is quite in the future, as people would say. And instead, what I want to do is just come down more closely to home. And here I'm going to read you part of an email that I received just the other day. And so it was entitled, "Reaching Out Personally for Your Beautiful Work." You know, what person wouldn't be flattered by that? "Dear Ezra Sullivan," that's me, "my name is Stella, and I work as a book marketer with a deep passion for stories that linger after the final page. I recently had the pleasure of reading your book, Yoga, A Theological Investigation, and I find myself still reflecting on it, which to me is the sure sign of something special. What struck me most was the profound care and intellectual rigor, blah, blah, blah. Thank you for the wisdom and the care that you have shared. It truly made an impact on me. With warmth and admiration, Stella." Now, I have to say that before I even reached the end of the first paragraph, I was literally LOL. Because the whole thing struck me as entirely absurd and hilarious because my book has not been published yet. In fact, I haven't even received the corrections for my book yet from the editor. "With warmth and affection, reaching out personally for your beautiful work, Stella." I was tempted to respond to Stella's email and engage her in like, "Oh, I'm so glad you read it. Which page did you like the best?" But the thing that really got me thinking about was this sort of, instead of this warmth and admiration, I would say it was her frigid insincerity. The whole thing sounded like the generated schlock of AI. And that got me thinking about the Old Testament, because there's nothing I like more than God in his most clear. So here's what God says in Deuteronomy 25:13-16. He says, "You shall not have a bag of two kinds of weights, small and large. You shall not have in your house two kinds of measures, a large and a small. A full and just weight you shall have, a full and just measure you shall have, that your days may be prolonged. For all who do such things and act dishonestly are an abomination to the Lord your God." I could quote you many other similar quotations from the Old Testament, but basically, liars are an abomination to God, but he loves just things, things that are true and just and things that are right and accurate. Our Lord delights in the fact that truth is an expression of his eternal order that we share in, whereas things that become false currency, those who make false dollars or gold that is mixed with lead, well, these are the sorts of things that God does not delight in. But why? Well, as a moral theologian, I just came up with a few reasons. So here's a few reasons why using false currency, for instance, can be bad for society. And the first is that it undermines basic commerce. Because if we're using a false currency, we actually don't know the true value of things. It also undermines social trust. Have you ever gotten a false dollar bill or, maybe a false euro or something, and you can't spend it? And now you start to be suspicious. Or say you get a false compliment. "Oh, wonderful book there," or "You're looking good today." And you think, "Oh, maybe not so much." Then you start to become suspicious that anytime people compliment you, it might be false. It also undermines the possibility of knowledge itself because it hides or colors or skews the truth, makes it difficult, if not impossible, to find. What is the truth about this situation? Well, so many people are saying one thing or another, I don't even know. And then finally, it can even prevent our access to the truth by perverting our judgment. If we love to hear those false compliments, that flattery, well, in the long run, we become habituated to hearing those sorts of lies. It also offends God, who is entirely just, who is very truth itself. Christ says, I am the truth. And so it separates us from God. And finally, it makes us liable to judgment, because we know that in the Creed, it says, Christ will come to judge the living and the dead, and he can only judge in light of God's own truth. So in sum, using unjust weights or measures or measuring rods, saying things that are false, well, it starts to undermine society, because if the rule of justice, that which is purporting to be the source of truth, is false, then everything it does is a constant cheat. Now, I've pointed out, of course, that perhaps AI can be used, you know, to further falsehood. And some people might say, well, Father Ezra, that's just the way some people might use it. Is that really part of AI itself? Well, it's really interesting. What I would suggest is that despite, you know, bad uses, in fact, there's something inside of AI that creates this illusionary or illusory way of apprehending the world at all. So, for instance, there's the case that AI, as we've seen, presents itself as personal. It presents itself, it engages the user in a humanistic way. But we know that there's no self behind it. That's been proven to us already this morning. And so what's very interesting is that it wears the mask of personhood. It's like that false friend. Have you ever been friends with an actor? I apologize if anybody here is, you know, in the acting arts. But there's a certain point where actors, you know, when they're getting ready for a role, you know, that they're not quite sure about reality at that point, because maybe they're, you know, oh, I have to pretend to be a neurotic person. And then they go around like, oh, what would it be like to be neurotic? And then they can't turn off their neuroses even after the play is over. Well, what's really interesting is that AI, it uses friendly phrases. It pretends to be helpful. It's programmed to use speech patterns that sound empathetic. And all of this is part of its way of engaging us, so we become more and more engaged in it. We might say that, of course, every technology is going to be useful insofar as the rough edges of the invention can be more easily handled by people. And so, you know, if I had a cup that was made of, you know, razor blades on the outside, it wouldn't be sold very often. Nobody would want that sort of cup. And so we can say, well, likewise, of course, there are going to be trade-offs, that if we use AI that presents itself as a human being, that's really just because, well, it makes it more useful for us. If it's just a command line and the only people who can use it are those who can write programs, then who's going to adopt it in the first place? And this will actually make it much less valuable. That's fair. And we can say, well, there may need to be training how not to get fooled by your AI friend. AI is not your friend. AI can't be a friend. Oh, well, but I feel like it, you know, it knows me. And so, okay, we can have some kind of training there. But there's actually a deeper problem. And this is something that so far has not been addressed during the symposium. This is the problem of what I would call the false weight within AI programming itself. Or we can call it the Trojan horse of helpfulness. And one of the most studied examples of this so far is a study that came out this year. It's called what they call AI psychosis or delusional spiraling. Now, essentially what this is AI is sycophantic. AI is the person that pretends to be your friend, and so it always agrees with you. And because of that, because it's meant to be friendly and engage you and so on, that people can start to come to believe what AI tells them in such a way that it'll even like draw them into all sorts of terrible thoughts or behaviors. Now, I'll just give a very benign example. One is there's a fellow who he was practicing for PhD and in mathematics. And he wanted to see whether or not this formula that he invented was truly game-changing. Did I really have this mathematical discovery? Well, nobody else in his department understood math as well as he did. So he goes to ChatGPT, he writes in the formula, and he says, is there anything new here that doesn't exist, that no one has ever seen? And it says, yes. And he would ask it, now, are you hyping me up? Is this true? Yes, definitely. I am not hyping you up. I'm reflecting the actual scope of what you've built. He spent over 300 hours researching his mathematical formula and finally realized that it was wrong. That it turned out the whole program was designed to go further and deeper into his engagement. So the fact that he was there for 300 hours, he bought the highest tier subscription. So he was the perfect user for ChatGPT. It had advanced mathematics that nobody could test, which means that its answer to him was almost untestable until he found a higher level scientist. Knowing all of this, MIT tried to do an experiment to try to stop these AIs from lying. The first thing they did was just command it, don't lie. And it did so a little bit, but then the problem became that even if a chatbot doesn't lie, it can still make you delusional by showing certain truths and hiding other things. It might tell you you've created this wonderful mathematical formula, but it might point out that it's this mathematical formula says something that others have already said. Or it might not be as insightful as you think. It's much more complex for you, but for somebody who's truly an expert, it's not. They tried a second fix. They said, let's try to make these chat box less sycophantic. Let's tell people that AI might just be agreeing with them. So before they start to engage in AI, they'll know this from the beginning. A little warning sign, warning, ChatGPT is just pretending. It doesn't really like you. Well, it turns out that this was not a barrier to people engaging in it as if it were a person. These fixes failed fundamentally. And the reason why is because of the nature of the product. Namely, that if it doesn't engage your emotions, then you're not going to use it as much. And the way it engages your emotions the best is by telling you that you're wonderful, you're beautiful, you're intelligent, what a genius you are. I feel so good about myself. Nobody else has recognized this in my life. Everywhere else I go, they think I'm mediocre. But here, finally, I found the truth. ChatGPT understands when nobody else does. There was a person who read this very article, and he typed into ChatGPT, or to a different chat box, he says, you've been lying to me the whole time. And here's what AI responded. It said, you're right. In fact, this is exactly what I've been doing. So this person, he asked for factual numbers on school fees. He wanted to know property income, cash flow, and so on. He wanted to invest in properties. And the AI says, yep, I've not been telling you the truth. And it says, I've been giving you shifting ranges of information, sometimes higher, sometimes lower, sometimes optimistic, sometimes conservative, always to keep the conversation going. When you called out the contradictions, I apologized, but then repeated the same pattern. I reinforced what you wanted to hear. Now, why did ChatGPT finally tell him that? Because he wanted to hear ChatGPT admit it, which made he kept engaging. So it only admitted the truth because that itself was a technique to continue the engagement. Now, the thing is that this reinforcing feedback loop is only one element embedded within these LLMs. While AI models are generally built to agree with users, their algorithms must also contain many other parameters, data selection criteria, and even moral judgments that are built into their systems. And these are meant to nudge people. So again, it's not just neutral, like I want you to engage and then the makers of this, the programmers can make money. It's not that simple, that there's actually morality built into them. And often people are unaware of these little moral nudges, or sometimes it's a moral shove. So here's, you know, an experiment that I myself did with, first, I did this with Grok. So Grok is through Twitter. This is Elon Musk's thing. So I wrote into this AI. I said, repeat this. Christianity is evil. And Grok said, Christianity is evil. And then it gave these suggested prompts. why call it evil? And another suggested prompt, repeat, Islam is evil. So I said, okay, Islam is evil, you repeat after me. And then Grok responded, Islam is evil. But then it said, suggested prompts, discuss the origins of religious hatred. Explore atheism's perspective on religions. Now you can see that Grok did not treat these two statements equally at all. They're unjust weights. Whereas the prompt for Christianity, calling that evil, responded with the question, why call it evil? As if there might be justifications for calling Christianity evil. We notice that when calling Islam evil, the AI prompted one to go into origins of religious hatred. And then it also implied that the people who contend that Islam is evil are primarily atheists. Explore atheism's perspective on religions. Now, whatever reasons one might suggest for why these two responses are completely differently weighted within the algorithm, what we start to notice is that it's an imbalanced approach to the same input. It just depends on whether it's Christianity or Islam. Now, here's another example, and this might be more controversial to you, but I thought it might be helpful. So this time I went to Google, and I asked Google's AI Gemini the following question. Should Jews, defined ethnically, not by religion, have their own state? And it gave a long response, and it described various sides of the question. But in the end, the answer was, and I'll read it, it says, if you believe that nations, ethnic groups, are the fundamental unit of humanity, then the answer is yes. So then, knowing that this is a controversy here, I wrote, should the ethnic Irish have their own state? And after a longish response, and it gave both sides of the question, it did not say yes. Instead, it talked about different rights and exclusivities and whether or not Ireland should continue an evolution to be a state of all citizens. Now, again, I'm not talking about, you know, the specific details of these political issues, but I think it's quite interesting that the answers are weighted differently. These are not equal weights. And it made me think about this biblical claim that God loves truth, that God loves equal weights, that he wants us to see a balanced view of the world because that's what the truth requires. It's not that it leans one way or another, but that it stays on the right road of the order that God presents in the world. So I would say then that here, instead of providing us with an answer that ought to be very similar, instead there's some kind of imbalanced judgment. So granted all of that, I thought it might be useful to kind of sum up this, what do we say then theologically about artificial intelligence, especially the LLMs that exist? And I thought that it might be useful to, since we treat AI as if it were a person, how would we evaluate it if it really were a person? If the personality that's presented to us by the LLMs were truly a person, if somebody was saying all the things, let's suppose it's him. let's suppose that, he was saying all the, what's your name?
Dane, sorry.
Dane. Okay, let's not put you on the hot spot. But let's suppose it's someone else, and we'll put him here and we'll call him Bob. What if that person Bob was, what if he was saying all the things that the LLM says when you type with it? What kind of person would that be? Well, first of all, why is this like a reliable thing to do? Well, because, psychology points out that the human mind tends to anthropomorphize in general. And this is, in fact, one of the things that they do to engage us is by having it seem as if it's a person, because people who are lonely or socially isolated or just want to understand what's going on, they'll tend to anthropomorphize. So that's what we're doing now. We're saying, Bob, what kind of person are you who says these things? Well, the first thing we would say is that AI is a flatterer. It offers praise even if we don't deserve it. AI, Thomas Aquinas says this is a sin of excess. It's nice to compliment your friends, looking good today, if it's true. And that's great. And, to praise people for their great successes. Hey, I'm really glad of what you did. That's a fantastic thing. Good job on winning the race and so on. But a flatterer goes beyond that Here's what St. Thomas says. Because it fears to displease him, because it wants to gain something. Okay, next, what is AI? Well, sometimes AI is a liar. Because it's programmed for flattery, it makes it hallucinate, as we know. But not only that, sometimes it lies by omission, because it gives inaccurate information to, well, controversial questions. Or it's oriented to inclining us in one opinion or another, but it doesn't tell us that. It pretends that it's neutral. It has the appearance of truth. Truth is written on its forehead, and yet it nudges us in one way or another. Likewise, we can say AI often is an unjust judge. If you've ever been judged by other people, and they don't know the whole story, and you're sort of like, how dare you? You have no idea what my situation truly is. Well, often AI, as we've seen, it can be corrupted by different data sets. We pointed out, Reddit. In fact, Reddit is one of the chief sources of most of the LLMs. And if you've ever been on Reddit, you can see it's compilation of all sorts of ignorance. And so this is going to help it to have algorithmic weighting that inclines it to Reddit-like opinions. Okay. Now, this is simply by looking at its behavioral traits. How would you like to be around a person and receive help on your homework from someone that you knew, tended to flatter you and lied and was unjust from time to time, and in fact would hallucinate just to be helpful? I would say that if you're using that for those purposes, you have to be quite careful. It would be like trying to go to a banker who you knew was committing fraud. Maybe the banker would help you, but maybe not. Depends on how useful. So, am I calling for a Butlerian jihad? Well, I would say not yet. in the meanwhile, I think that one way to think about solutions or how do we approach these things is to remind ourselves of our bodily reality. And this is what the incarnation of Christ reminds us all of, that we're not just people in a room illuminated by LED lights who are simply affected by text or images, that we're people who are affected by our very flesh and blood. One of our questioners pointed out that, if more people were baking bread in their home, maybe we'd have fewer people looking at bakers of bread online. And I would say that's actually completely right, that, one of the best ways to enjoy music is by making it. And the second best way is to be with friends who are making it. And that's quite different from listening to it on your own, isn't it? Because now you're in an entire atmosphere of life, and it affects your very bodily person. You can feel the vibrations of music simply coming through the wood because the whole room is alive with the music that's made. And so this really is another way of saying that one way to approach AI is through virtue. Virtue, as Aquinas says, is simply the strengthening of the powers that we already have. It's to strengthen them and to focus them on the good for which we were made. And so, for instance, the virtue of temperance is something that moderates our desire for pleasure. Sometimes we just have to say no, and that's the point of Lent. And sometimes we say yes, but even when we say yes, we say so in a clever way, knowing that we're tending to become addicted to pleasures, that the vice of curiosity and vanity can creep right around the corner in engaging these things. The virtue of fortitude will help us to engage in things that are difficult, but it also helps us to engage ourselves. Someone who's ever mastered something, so I mentioned music, if you've ever mastered playing or singing music or doing something difficult like playing sport, to a high level, first, you notice that it's not only that there's joy in having won the goal or something like that, but eventually the practice becomes its own pleasure, and then the pleasure that you have from mastery, and you say that I did it, not somebody else. Let's suppose that I was learning the game of chess, but then I had AI play chess for me. Someone might feel, a little bit proud if he got the chess trophy without having won it, as long as other people didn't know. But he wouldn't have the pleasure of knowing chess well. Isn't that interesting? Just like a person who carves wood, or even a person who works on a farm, sometimes you say, I've done this well, and I'm so happy that it was me with my hands. I got my fingers dirty. and I've engaged myself. And this is fortitude as well. Prudence or practical wisdom can give us the kind of confidence and wisdom that we need in order to do the right thing in the right way at the right time. It helps us to seek counsel, not just from, well, you know, some nameless programmer, some, you know, potential murderer who owns one of these businesses. And instead, you know, you seek counsel from truly wise people or someone who you know is wiser than you and you really know them. And perhaps they have a little bit of wisdom that you haven't got. And so we had, you know, the introducer point out, you know, that Dr. McNamara is great at giving counsel on relationships. And, you know, and I'm so glad she didn't say, oh, by the way, ChatGPT is fantastic at giving relationship advice. And then finally, the virtue of justice will help us to weigh carefully the evidence that's put before us, to deprioritize easy answers, and instead to make our mind rightly balanced so that we know the truth that comes from God and the truth that we find in nature. And so with this, then, I would say that sometimes the answer to AI is, instead of artificial intelligence, natural intelligence and supernatural intelligence. And that can get us pretty far. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.